Good morning, I want to welcome each one of you to the, or everyone, to the Second Court of Appeals. I understand that everybody's ready to proceed, but before we begin, I want to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Brian Walker, and I'm Bonnie Sarah, and I'm the Chief Justice of the Court. And before we begin also, I'd like to call the case.
The court will now call Garrett D. Brown versus Matthew Robert Stone. May it please the court, Mr. Anthony Cuesta will argue for the appellant. Mr. Trey Harlan will argue for the appellee.
Good morning, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Anthony Cuesta with the law firm Decker Jones. I represent Garrett Brown as the appellant in this case. First, allow me to apologize for raising 7 issues in this appeal. I tried my hardest to whittle it down to 3. I found the task unachievable, especially since we raised issues across every phase of litigation. We raised issues in pretrial, we challenged the court's motion for summary judgment rulings, and a dismissal of our supplemental counterclaim based off of special exceptions. And then at the trial phase, we raised issues that not only concerned the fact that we were going to a trial that was predicated on these pretrial errors, in our opinion, but also other issues that just occurred as a result of the trial. And then we even raised a post-trial issue, which deals with language that made it into the final judgment. There was language that broadened the scope of an express easement, so much so that it would require my client to demolish a garage and to repair and renovate retaining wall items that had been there for a very long time. And the problem with that was that the issue was never adjudicated. It was never litigated. It wasn't even brought to my attention until 7 days after trial, when that language was brought into the final judgment. So I realize I'm not going to be able to address all 7 issues with you here today. So my plan for today is to address the first 3, the pretrial issues. I believe that a reversal on any one of these pretrial issues would result in a remand and a new trial on everything that happened afterwards, because they're all connected like a row of dominoes. Now, Your Honors,
let me ask you a question, Counsel. Let's just get to the harder issue.
Yes, sir.
Neither of the parties in the briefing brought to the court's attention any case that had dealt with the issue of whether there's a distinction to be made between, with regard to the fact that all of the conveyances that we're dealing with here were done through vendor's lanes, and the argument that's being made by Mr. Stone is that because all of the conveyances, both with regard to Smallwood and with regard to Moore & May, were made by vendor's lien, that neither Smallwood nor Moore & May actually at any point in time owned Superior Title or Fee Simple, and therefore merger could not in fact occur. I did actually find a case that dealt with that same exact situation, which is a Waco Court of Appeals case called Franks versus Toby, which nobody that I could recall cited to this. It's a 2022 case. But the issue that we're facing, which is, does the fact that there is a retention of Fee Simple by the vendor with equitable title going to vendee, does that mean that there is not a unity of ownership vis-a-vis the application of the merger principle? So y'all might do a post-judgment, post-argument briefing with regard to this case. It doesn't actually address, but it does apply merger in the context of vendor's liens, without addressing the argument that's actually made by Mr. Schmidt. My question So my understanding, would you agree, this is an issue of first impression vis-à-vis whether or not merger can actually ever be applied with regard to an easement when all of the properties that are involved have conveyances that are vendor's lien?
Yes, sir. I would agree. This is a matter of first impression. We both actually, I say we, I mean, opposing counsel Trey Harlan and I, we both researched this quite a bit. We both discussed it quite a bit, and I think we would both agree, neither one of us found a case that, as you mentioned, dealt specifically with whether or not a vendor's lien would prevent unity of ownership for purposes of the merger doctrine. So, yes, I agree with you. I believe this is a matter of first impression.
Okay. Is there agreement that Ms. Smallwood owned all of the properties involved with this, and that she owned them by virtue of conveyances? This includes Ms. King's half interest by virtue of conveyances that involve vendor's liens with a single financial institution. I believe it was an ASL financial institution, or did she have multiple vendors with regard to each of these properties?
There is no dispute that Ms. Smallwood in 1997 came to own, and I use that term in its plain meaning, came to own all the lots at issue. With regards to how many of those specific lots she acquired by vendor's lien, I don't recall exactly how many of them were. In my mind, the argument would be the same. There was just one lot that had a vendor's lien that affected unity of ownership, or there was two or three. If there's just one and a vendor's lien prevents unity of ownership, then one is enough. You know, we're not going to have unity of ownership. Our position has been that because Texas is a lien theory state, you have to consider what rights a lien holder has with regards to what rights an owner has. And that's sort of what I was trying to emphasize in my briefing was, let's look at the cases, let's look at the policy and the theory behind the merger doctrine. And really the focus has always been on ownership, specifically ownership, in the plainest meaning of the sense, the rights that embody ownership as we think about it in everyday life. A right to use, possess, enjoy. Those are the rights that make an easement on your own property pointless. These other issues, when we talk about legal and equitable title, that gets into the legality of vendor's liens and the effect that it has on other things, like the rights of a vendor to the property. These contingent rights that don't take effect until maybe there's a default on a loan, that sort of a thing, you know, or the default goes the other way. What rights does an owner have to force a lien holder to release the lien on the property? They've done everything they had to. That, what I've been trying to emphasize, is a separate issue from the issue that deals with the merger doctrine. And we go back to 1888, 150 years, and what we see in these cases is a very logic-based, a very simplified way of looking at it. And it's quite simply, if you own the property, and I, again, the plain meaning of the word own, just the way we think about it in everyday life, if you own the property, why would you need an easement over the property? So, there's a lien holder.
But if you own the property subject to a security interest of another, whether that security interest is created by a mortgage, okay, in which case the red, what is it, flag red firm that discusses both the mortgage conveyance and the vendor loan conveyance, and makes a distinction. But still, what you're dealing with is effectively a security interest in property. Okay. Under the mortgage situation, it's you're retaining a security interest, but ownership does in fact pass with the mortgage, according to that case. With a vendor's lien, ownership doesn't actually ever pass until you've paid off you've paid off the amount that you said you were going to pay for. It's almost like a rent-to-own situation, except in the context. The remedies were very different too, okay? Because in fact, under the vendor's lien situation, the vendor can seek rescission, but there are some limitations on rescission. So even if we go with what is effectively what you're arguing, what I sense you're arguing, is more of a ownership as evidenced by possession, okay? Even under the vendor's lien situation, and going way back to the 19th century, the vendor could kick somebody off the property or take the property and take possession of the property without having to go to court to validate their ownership interest, because their ownership interest never had passed. Okay, and that goes back to like a 1856 case, all right? The others are they can sue for foreclosure to get the amount of money that they're still owed on the property. And they can also go for rescission under the trespass to try title. So bottom line is if your model is a possession model, okay, that if you're in possession, then you're the owner. But from an actual legal standpoint, that's not what we do on anything. I mean, you've got to, if somebody else has an interest in it, they can validate that interest through the courts. So that's why I think this is such a unique issue, is because it's very difficult. Your points are well made with regard to the case law says exactly that these simple never actually transfer to Ms. Smallwood or Mr. Bordelmay. Okay. Did I even get that correct? Yeah. Is it Bordelmay?
Bordelmay.
Okay, sorry. Is there a distinction to be made though that because Smallwood actually retained possession and never was in default, which would activate the security interest at all? Is there something to be argued there? It's not a possession argument, but it's a lack of default argument with regard to she maintained ownership because she did what she did, everything she was supposed to do to maintain ownership.
Yes, Your Honor, and quite frankly, I've traveled down this path of thought on the issue, and this is what has made sense to me. First of all, we're speaking about ownership as if it's a defined term. But for purposes of the merger doctrine, this is a new issue that we have to explore. What is ownership? For purposes of the merger doctrine, what is ownership? And I keep going back to ownership is...
Well, no, it's right. What is unity of ownership?
Right, okay. But that's
what we're doing. Is unity of ownership that you have to own every estate whatsoever, legal and equitable?
Correct, exactly, which is different from unity of title, unity of legal title and equitable title. When we're talking about the merger doctrine, it goes back to what is the philosophy behind the merger doctrine. It's, as an owner, you acquire certain rights. We're talking about the bundle of sticks, and there's going to be unlimited number of rights within that bundle of sticks. So for purposes of the merger doctrine, out of that bundle of sticks, which are the rights that make an easement on your own property pointless? You have equitable title and legal title severed over here. How does that affect your right as an owner, however we define that term, to, let's say, expressly terminate an easement on your own property? And this is the path that my thinking has led me down. If Ms. Smallwood, in 1997, when she owned all the properties, if she wanted to expressly terminate every easement, that lien holder, the vendor's lien, would not have prevented it from happening. She would have been able to expressly terminate every easement.
So then, why not? If the lien holder has a security interest in the property, the lien holder has a security interest in every aspect of the property. Does that security interest not include a UCC or an easement according to the property that they have security interest in?
Only if she would have defaulted, which never happened. And that's one of the questions you raised earlier. So whatever she would have done would have been subject to the vendors, like the vendors then came first in time. So if she terminated expressly every easement in the case, they cannot have prevented that from happening.
Okay.
Unless you default.
Then she default.
She did not.
But unless you default.
Right.
Then all of a sudden, the easement, the security interest, is there such a thing as a security interest in an easement? The security interest is in the property as is.
Right.
She says, I don't need the easements anymore. Fine, thank you very much. But then boom, the security interest kicks in when she defaults, and the mortgager or the vendor is like, well, wait a minute. Hey, you know, this property has a value, a part of which is defined by its use and therefore by any easements. So there's, you know, the superior state, the dominant state, the servient state. We need to be able to sell both. So we need to be able to sell the servient estate, you know, do we get rid of the seller, do we get rid of the access or there's value attached to the property or a burden attached to the property depending upon which one of those properties are being sold, and you've got a security interest in both. So how does she have the right to do away with the easement when there's a security interest involved?
It becomes subject to the security interest. So if that's why a foreclosure undoes whatever the holder of the property.
So our suggested rule here should be that effectively while she is properly paying for her paying off her financing with regard to this, as long as she never defaults, that when that passes without a default to somebody else, then it effectively effectuates the merger at that point in time.
I believe the logical approach is that it essentially a foreclosure or a default would act as a reversion. And I think logically, I'm fairly certain about this, I don't believe that the vendors would have been able to prevent her from terminating every easement expressly had she chosen to do so. However, if she defaulted, then just like it happens often in mineral interest cases, that foreclosure would have undone whatever had occurred under the owner's purview before the default.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was quick.
You didn't know I was going to be doing most of the arguments.
Good morning. My name is Trey Harlan. I represent Matt Snell, my wife and co-counsel, Melody Harlan. I'm honored to be here before you today, and I'll try my best to answer your questions. First of all, whenever you were asking about whether or not anybody else had an interest in it, the L.C. Calvin King Trust also had a vendor's lien. Whenever you're asking if anybody other than Azle State Bank had a vendor's lien, Azle State Bank had a vendor's lien for most of the properties that Smallwood acquired, but then on the northwest property, whatever one half interest was sold to the LZ Calvin King Senior Revocable Living Trust maintained a vendor's lien on that was never paid off during the period of time that Smallwood owned the property. It was
When did he pay it off? How was she able to convey it?
She actually paid it off she actually paid it off, I believe, in 2006 or 7, whenever she transferred it over to Bordermain. But before that time in 2000, the southwest property had been transferred to the Herrings. So she no longer had, even if she would have owned everything, at the time that she paid everything out, there was no longer unity of ownership because the Herrings, who also had an easement, had use of that easement, they're the ones in the southwest. They purchased the southwest property at that time. So it broke it off in 2000. In 2000, the alleged unity broke off, and then it wasn't until, I believe, 2006 that she paid off all the vendor's liens. Also, I did look at that Hubby case. Where I put my notes. And my understanding of the Hubby case was that, I can't remember A and B and who it was, but there was three different tracts of land. And to start off with, A owned 76.35 acres and 17 acres. And then B owned 37 acres.
There was an easement across three pieces of land, which...
Right.
And so the question became, did the purchase of by one of the landowners of a second part of that cancel the easement as to those two pieces of land? And Waco basically said it did. But and the owner of the third larger piece of land could not continue with the easement across the other two pieces.
I agree.
I'm not sure I agree with how they came out with that, but looking at briefing at Supreme Court, because once I saw there were vendor's liens involved with regard to the merger case, I was looking to see what the briefs were. Nobody ever raised the argument that you raised with regard to there's not unity of ownership because of the vendor's lien situation.
So, well, I'm sorry, but what I saw on it, though, was that that was raised was that the 76.35 had originally given the easement to the 37, and then whenever 37 bought that 17 acres from the 76.35, he did not maintain, he didn't have any language in his deed where he maintained that easement to where it was for his benefit, because it was never for his benefit, it was just for 37's benefit, so he never had any language that provided an easement specifically for him, so it did merge away in that situation. At least that was my read on it. Since we're on merger, I'll go ahead and speak about merger just for a moment, that it is our position that the vendor's liens show that whoever the vendor is, the specific vendor, whether it be Hazel State Bank or the Elsa Calvin King Senior Revocable Living Trust, that they had legal title on it. And Brown argues that under the Taylor versus Brennan case, that Texas is a lien theory state with the mortgagee not being the owner of the property. However, Taylor versus Brennan is easily distinguishable from the case that we have because in Flag Red Fern, they differentiated between a simple deed of trust and a vendor's lien. And I'll just read a quote from Flag Red Fern. The distinction between a vendee and a mortgager. A mortgager, as the owner of the legal estate, can convey legal title of mortgage property. A foreclosure proceeding is required to divest the rights of the owner of the legal interest. On the other hand, if a vendor's lien encumbers the land, legal title does not pass to the vendee. A vendee owns the equitable interest along with the contract for the purchase of land. And our position the whole time is that if she didn't have fee simple on the property, that she didn't have a unity of title where the merger could even apply. But
since we're dealing with an easement and we're dealing with the usage and the merger doctrine is did specifically with use. In other words, if you have essentially possession, control of all the property, and nobody has the right to tell you, you can't go to that part of your property or use that part of your property, you know, in particular way, then the easement goes away. It's a possession type of ownership issue. And so at no point in time, once Smallwood purchased and all of this property was conveyed to her, you're not arguing that she could not have used any of that property the way she wanted to, based solely upon the fact that there was not a title someplace else.
Yes, she could have used it the same way that someone who rents property can use it. But she, you know, if someone rents property, they have the ability to go wherever, but they don't have the right to try to transfer it out. They don't have the right to do away with the easements. Also, and that's what the Flag Red Firm case talked about, was whether or not you have legal title versus equitable title. And as you've touched on, that if you have equitable title, or let's say you just have a deed of trust, and there's, so the mortgagor has, what's the legal title with the equitable title?
Well, the right of possession, though, in terms of the right of use, is in the equitable loan. Is it not?
Well, it's in the right of use to use it, but the ability to knock out all the easements is not there, because it's not just...
What authority do you have for that? That's part of the problem that I'm dealing with here, is I don't think there's any authority from you or the other. I understand the argument you're making, and I understand Flag Red Firm, it says exactly what you're saying. And I went back in the 19th century in all those cases.
Right.
Say exactly the same thing, okay? But still, whether you're a mortgagee or you're a vendor, you still have to effectively go to court to enforce. On the mortgagee, you have to go and get title back. Okay. On the vendor, you have to go enforce the title you were obtaining.
Right.
They're two separate, you know, one's foreclosure, the other is trespass to private title, but that's only in the event of rescission. And there are still some equitable limitations on what you can and cannot do, particularly if the vendee has made a substantial number of payments on it. So the bottom line, but the easement, it's a pertinent to the property itself. Is it a title issue, or is it a possession issue? And so that's where I don't think anybody's discussed the merger doctrine with regard to how it gets applied under these circumstances. So that's why I'm making a lot of arguments right now.
Right, and I understand, and I do believe that if there is a case out there, we wouldn't have spent four years on it beforehand. But there is, my other point on that, though, is that even if there would have been unity of title, the merger doctrine is not automatic. And this court in Steiger versus Munster announced that the merger is disfavored in Texas, and per Flag Red Firm and this court's determination in Steiger, to prove the affirmative defense of merger, Brown had the burden of proving six elements that Brown neither proved nor even attempted to prove. And I can list those out if you'd like to, but I don't think it's necessary.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Do you think that this is an issue of first impression? Because, well, let me say it this way. I always appreciate attorneys being creative, thinking through and coming up with various theories to a certain litigation. Do you think it's possible, though, that the reason that there isn't a case is because nobody's actually alleged this theory before? Nobody's actually given this a shot?
I don't know if it's that no one's ever alleged it. I think it's more that it was probably alleged at some point along the way. It was resolved in the trial court, and it never went to an appeal.
Yeah.
Well, let me, one thing that I do want to ask questions about some of the other issues. Bottom line is if, because of the vendor lien situation, Fee Simple never actually goes to the vendee, okay? Then what rights do the, so you're basically saying the vendee has
no rights to build a house. You know, what if she decided she wanted to build a house on the property in question here, but the subject of the easement? She wouldn't be able to do that?
And she can do that if she goes ahead and makes good on the payment to the vendor.
Well, that gets me back to what we were talking about, is if she never defaults, then basically anything she does, then why would the merger not be effectuated if she never defaults before she conveys it? In other words, is she in fact an owner who can do anything she wants with the property and put up a fence that blocks the easement because she owns every bit of it? But then all of a sudden, if she defaults, then the easement kicks back in and a change in the property that she did while she was in possession goes away. Is that effectively the argument, that it's a accoutrement of title and not of possession?
She's an equitable owner of the property. She has the equitable interest, not the legal interest in it. And in the same sense, if she were to, as a person with a deed of trust, not a vendor's lien, if she were to establish some easements, that she decided to give two or three easements to other people and then she did default, then those are voidable by the vendor whenever they come back in. Whenever they take the property, they can go back to square one where they were before if they want to do that. And my point is that she can improve the property, and as long as she makes good on paying the vendors, then, you know, it continues. She, at that point, whenever she pays them off, it merges to where that she has both the legal title and the equitable title is found in Flag Red Fern.
Then why did that not merge when she fulfilled all of her obligations for each of the different vendor's liens that she had when she owned all of the property?
Because she got rid of part of the property before she fulfilled all of her obligations under the vendor's liens. In 2000, whenever she sold the property to Herring, that broke the unity of title. Again, if there was unity of title, it broke it, because now she only has part of the properties. Herring owns part of it, and it wasn't until 5 or 6 years later, after she sold part of it to Herring, that she ended up knocking off the two vendors that she had, where she paid off the two vendors. And at that point, when she would have received legal title, it had already broken the unity of title.
Remind me, Herring came before Tyner, right?
Herring came before Tyner, yes, Tyner.
I do have a question that I haven't been able to discern, and this goes to the memo language.
Yes.
Were you permitted by Judge Gallagher to argue to the jury that Mr. Stone suffered mental anguish because Mr. Brown did not comply with Judge Gallagher's ruling with regard to summary judgment and award? I think to think in one of the briefs I read, it was a quote during our oral argument at the end, closing argument, that specifically Mr. Brown held the judge's ruling against him as part of the argument with regard to the language suffered by Mr. Stone. Did that happen?
The yes and no. The point where the judge said that that Brown had held all the orders in contempt, that was done after the trial. During the trial,
that was not in front of the jury.
That was not in front of the jury. But during the trial, with no objection made by Brown, the MSJ was brought in. That was part of one of the exhibits. And the temporary restraining order was one of the exhibits, and the temporary injunction was one of the exhibits. And they were put in for the determination, not necessarily of whether or not he broke the injunction, or whether or not he did not follow the injunction. But the effect of him not doing that on Matt, because as he continually bullied him along the way to where the judge has said, don't build any more fence. So the first thing he does is build some more fence.
Did the jury get also the order denying both motions for contempt? Did they get that? Did that go into evidence too?
I don't believe so.
Okay, so the jury's asked for pardon and language damages to consider the fact that Mr. Brown is being, let's say, less than helpful with regard to the rulings of the court. The court is specifically given an opportunity to make that finding and declines to do so, but then the court basically allows the jury to hold Mr. Brown in contempt as part of the mental anguish finding?
Yes, with no objection from Brown about any of that coming in. If Brown wanted to object to that, he could have. If Brown wanted to, in the alternative, put in that this was presented to the judge and the judge did not find him in contempt, he could have tried that, but he didn't do either one of those. So there was no objection to that evidence coming in.
Okay, how is there's a finding of nuisance, but there's no finding of loss of use or impairment of market value. So how is there any authority that says impairment of enjoyment nuisance can exist when there's no finding of loss of use?
Well, there's findings of the ability to maintain a nuisance whenever it creates mental anguish on somebody. And what is important, though, is that the jury did not rubber stamp everything that I asked them to do. So in relation to the invasion of privacy, they asked the question whether or not the camera was on. And since they couldn't determine whether the camera was on, they said no invasion of privacy. On the loss of use, Matt was able to continually live there. So as far as the use of being able to sleep, cook, eat, bathe, he was able to do that. So the jury found no money for loss of use. On loss of market value, they awarded no money. But on the mental anguish aspect, they took into consideration that this had been a continual nuisance for 1,278 days. And I'd given them, per the Gregory case, I had given them a basis as to how to come up with what would be fair for mental anguish. If you do it on a daily basis, whether it's on the loss of use, I said 10, 50, 80, I think. And then on the mental anguish, I said it's going to be quite a bit more. They went back there, and if you look at $250,000, they came up, you know, this is our argument, a reasonable reason for why they did it. They may have gone back there and said, let's give them $200 a day, and then they looked at what number that would fit is more than $250,000, and they said, well, let's just reduce it down to $250,000. And that's a rational basis for them to, a rational basis for them to have given that amount, which is what is required under Gregory.
Thank you. Your Honors, let me begin by addressing the issue concerning the order coming in as evidence unobjected to. Had a decision to make at this point. The judge had already ruled in the partial motion for summary judgment that the easements applied, they were valid, they were enforceable, and more importantly, that Mr. Stone co-owned the center drive easement, that alleged easement land. So before we're even going into trial, there's already a ruling in place that says the fence divided Mr. Stone's property. Now, this is what I have been facing throughout litigation. The order, the summary judgment order, said that the fence was of such a nature that it should be removed immediately. I immediately filed a motion to modify which in part asked for clarity. Your Honor, you say should be. I looked at the case law. If an order is unambiguous, you know, we may or may not have to follow it. You're saying we should remove it. What does this mean? I set that motion for hearing five times. All this is in the record. Everything's in the record. I set it for hearing five times. I didn't get an answer until the pretrial hearing 3 days before trial. So I'm faced with all that in mind. I'm faced with a decision. What do I do? Do I object to this order? Because the order is just evidence. The ruling remains in place. I don't have to object to the motion for summary judgment order to preserve it. The case law on that is clear. It's preserved. I don't have to object to that.
But the summary judgment order said remove it immediately, did it not?
No, it said should remove. And that is why I didn't object to it, because I didn't want any more discretion on what the court said. This is what you ruled on, Your Honor? Let's give it to the jury.
Should remove.
I'm sorry?
The jury's not going to make a distinction. We should remove.
And that benefits us. Exactly, because that's what we're facing. They're arguing the fence was up for all this time, including after the motion for summary judgment, and now they have an order, and they could hear us saying, we asked the judge for clarity.
Did they argue to the jury that you were in violation of the court order?
I believe that came up. I believe it came up.
Was there an objection to that?
I don't recall if I objected to it or if we just argued as I just argued to you now. I don't recall. But what I'm trying to
you emphasize. See why I would be concerned with basically those that type of argument is basically putting your arm around the judge saying the judge and I agree that they were in violation, those guys over there.
Right.
And that, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I understand one of the points I make in my briefing is all of that is not evidence of a nuisance. All of that is not evidence of mental anguish caused by a nuisance. That's a separate issue. And of course, I argue in my briefing that despite all the allegations of contempt, there was never an order against my client finding him in contempt. The other thing,
so how do we get to what you want us to do with regard to equitable, an equitable title holder being immunity, and how do you address the Herring argument with regard to she never was, she, we argued a little bit earlier, we discussed a little bit earlier with you, and you're going to have time to add, we discussed a little. If she, when she paid everything off, well, if she already conveyed to the Herring before she paid everything off, why does that not blow up of ownership?
I believe we're conflating two separate issues. The merger doctrine, going back 150 years, has been a simple, simple doctrine that deals with unity of ownership. Unity of title is something different. And Flag Redfern deals with unity of title, and I don't believe Flag Redfern is applicable to the merger of easements. And I don't believe that is a matter of first impression. I believe the case law is pretty clear that Flag Redfern deals with the merger of 20 different estates, but not easements. And the reason I say that is because every single case that utilized the Flag Redfern elements or Flag Redfern, because even before it was Flag Redfern, the elements still existed.
Those were all title cases? Where title was being challenged in some way, shape, or form.
It wasn't just title, Your Honor, and it's in my briefing. It also dealt with might have been two different estates dealing with mineral interest. It could have been leaseholds. I think one of them dealt with leaseholds, but various things. And then
you get in trouble with the chief here. So.
Oh.
Thank you.
Sorry. Apologies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate your argument. Very, it's been helpful to us. And thank you for being here. Your case has not been submitted. And we're delayed.